It's great. Thanks, Mal. It's been great just to reflect a little on these images that we carry and pictures and impressions of God in our lives and in our world. It's a big part of who we are, whether we recognize it or not. Just wanted to start off, if anybody can tell me what the meaning of these words are. So, phobscotl. Does anybody know what a phobscotl is? No? Okay, well, that's a green fizzy drink where bubbles go down. Okay. Sorry, go up instead of down. All right, so there's a clue for you. Can anybody tell me what snozcumbers are? Cucumbers, they're quite large, aren't they? Yep. Scrumdiddlyumptious. Yeah. And whiz poppers. Farts. Okay, we had to get that one in there, didn't we? And my nephew, who's just turning 40, told me that when they cease to be funny, it's time to give up on life. But anyway, he has two teenagers who disagree with him. But yes, those words come from those of you who recognise them, the book by Roald Dahl, the BFG, the Big Friendly Giant. And for those of you who can recollect something of the story, it's the story of a young girl named Sophie, an orphan, and she's kidnapped by a giant. And she is terrified this giant is going to eat her like the other giants do. However, she quickly discovers that he's a big friendly giant, a BFG, who refuses to eat human beings and instead spends his time catching and delivering good dreams to children. So one of the things, we read the story a few times when our children were at home. It looks like we're going to be into round two shortly, because with Mokopuna, we're going to be reading that story again and again, no doubt, and hearing about it. But one of the things that strikes me in that story is the way that Sophie's relationship with the BFG was shaped by the ideas that were associated with the image of giants. She believed that all giants were dangerous, man-eating monsters, and they were to be feared. You can't trust them, and you daren't trust them, or you'll be consumed. But as she got to know the BFG, as she learned to image and see him differently, the fears melted, she began to feel safe. She felt connected, and she began to build trust. For a lot of people, their life journey with God is a little bit like that, except there's not one chapter in it. Sometimes there are several chapters of rediscovering and re-imaging God in different ways in order to feel safe, in order to build trust, in order to feel connection. And in the reading this morning that we had earlier from Isaiah's Gospel, there are a couple of core ideas that are presented and beliefs about God that the author references. And these were ideas that shaped the people of Israel's connection with God and expectations about God's presence and action in the world. And it's an interesting kind of a passage, because it starts off with this mention of a messenger, and the Hebrew word that is used there is one that suggests this messenger is a woman or a female, which is a little bit unusual given the patriarchal nature of the messaging about God that is pretty constant within throughout the Old Testament particularly, but also into the New. But at the heart of this picture of God are two different descriptions, two different images. And Mal has already brought those out. But just to remind you, there's this picture of a powerful, strong, ruling king. Isaiah says, "See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. His reward is with him, and his recompense before him." So there's the one image, the image of this powerful king or ruler. And then alongside it, there's this picture of a caring shepherd. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and gently leads the mother sheep, those who have young. And here there is this other picture that sits somewhat or juxtaposed, you might say, alongside this picture of the powerful king. So this God, according to the writer, is alive and present in the world, acting to support and bless and reward people, but also, according to the author, acting to oppose, curse and punish people. The author sees God at work in and through particular historical events. And as you read on through Isaiah, you will see some of those events described. One of them is their deliverance from their Babylonian oppressors through the actions of the Persian king Cyrus. And they see this deliverance from Babylonian exile as the act of this powerful, strong God on their behalf within the events of history. And then they see this action which enables them to return to the land that they have come from and been driven out of as the act of this tender, caring shepherd. It's a delicate and a tricky business trying to interpret personal and historical events through the lens or the image of God that you carry and your understanding of it. And some would say it's very fraught. But this is what the Old Testament people do, and this is what many of us do today. As we experience life and seek to understand it, we carry an image of God, and through that lens we look and try to understand and make sense of the lives that we live. These are powerful and at times troubling images that are carried around in people's minds and lives and communities. And in looking at this text, it led me to think, and I'm grateful, Mel, for what you've done this morning in curating our service to help us start to get a little, some thinking going already about this. You know, what ideas about God and life in the world have you grown up with? What sit within your embodied person? Because they don't just sit in our brains. You know, they sit in our neural pathways and in our bodies. They become embodied images that we live through and out of and with. I was recently reading the book Annam Cara by John O'Donohue, the Irish philosopher and poet. And I came across a passage where he talks about the perfectionist God. And it resonated with me because I realized that as a child, this was the God that I lived with and the God that I still live with. This is the God who calls us to be good, to calls us to be virtuous. And the sense that we have in life when we live with this image of God is that we're called to climb this ladder of virtue. And as we climb up it, this God will reward us. And we find there are certain points that we're trying to attain, and we may slip up and down the ladder, but we feel we may have reached a certain point on the ladder that, and then we look up and we see there are more rungs. And we haven't quite reached where we feel we need to be in order to be safe with God. So we must climb higher. One of my spiritual directors some years ago would talk to me on occasion about what he called my Avis mentality. Now, some of you remember a few years ago, Avis, the rental car company, used to have an add-on TV called We Try, and on the tagline was We Try Harder. And he would call me on this mentality when he would observe me talking about aspects of my life and ministry and say, this is emerging, this is a constant here, Sean. Why is this present in your life? Why do you feel you have to try so hard or do more or be better in order to be safe with God? But this is an image that was infused into me during childhood. How did it find its way into me? It came from my parents, my hard-working, working-class Catholic parents. It's not only working-class Protestants who carry this kind of image within them. It came from my the priests and the nuns who taught me. And it came from, obviously, the ongoing workings of my own psyche. Home, school, church, and in parts, the world around me reinforced that this is what God is like. And in order to be safe with God, you've got to live in this way. It was a really harmful and destructive image that I carried and still carry within me today. It doesn't easily, it doesn't just disappear. It comes to haunt me on at times. You know, this week starting back into work where I felt sluggish and slow, which I had a few days the week before, but it's kind of like here in the background is this scepter of the perfectionist God saying, you're not working hard enough, you're not producing enough, you need to be doing more, you need to be better. And whilst those images, those messages in ourselves at times are important, they can get a toxicity that leaves us shredded of any sense of safety and well-being in the world, and certainly any sense of connectedness to God. A God who is always demanding more of us is a God that you don't want to be in relationship with. I was earlier this year on a retreat at Little River, and I was thinking about some of these threads in my life around perfectionism and reflecting on some of my drivenness and some of my compulsions, feeling a little bit overwhelmed by it. And I took some time just to engage in some breath prayer, just to sit quietly and follow the intake of breath into my body and the exhale of breath and slowly just be present to that. And as I sat there, these thoughts came into my mind. I am enough. You are enough. Here is enough. Now is enough. I am enough. You are enough. Here is enough, and now is enough. And it was like those words, along with my breath, brought this stillness to my body and my mind. And I sensed that was the breath of the Spirit speaking to me about my place in the world, because God is the one who comes, among other things, to help us reimagine and rediscover who God is in a way that enables us to be safe and brave and loving in the world, as Rachel Held Evans reminds us of in that story. I wonder what ideas and images you have in your life, and ideas that have affected your way of being in the world, especially as they relate to God. Some of them perhaps that are empowering and energizing and freeing and enabling and bring wholeness and life into you, and others that suck the life out of you and leave you disconnected from God, wanting to walk away rather than walk toward, wanting to push off rather than embrace, feeling that you are not enough rather that you are enough. And part of this journey of faith discovery is an invitation to be able to reimagine and rediscover how we can be in relationship with God. The parallel passage that we read this morning, I just want to actually pull up, if I can, another image here. Do you just want to pop that up on screen, Hamish, that first one that I had? How many of you read The Shack? And those of you who have are no doubt familiar with the backstory of William Paul Young with that, who had an experience in his growing years of abuse in horrific forms from religious leaders. And part of his discovery, can we bring that on the screen as well? No? Okay. Let's go back to that one that you had. So Young says this, and this is born among other things. He wrote the book, and he creates this, I think, a beautiful picture of God as this African-American woman, turning on its head this image of father, which is so often associated with a white beard, white male, and seeks to invite us through the story to reimagine who God is. And he says this about what can happen for some of us, or perhaps many of us. that a lot of times we've painted God with the brush of our own damage. And if we've had an abusive history, we end up with an abusive God. If anger has been a huge issue, rage against us, we end up with an angry God. If our parents aren't there, we were abandoned, we were detached, we end up with a God who looks like that. We have this tendency of making God in our own image, and that image is broken. You know, his challenge here is to, there's an invitation, I guess, rather than a challenge. Let me put it that way. It's an invitation for us to re-examine the images that we carry within ourselves, both the ones that empower and the ones that disempower, and to find ways of reimagining and reconnecting with God through the re-examination and the reconstruction of those images that we carry. So in Matthew 16, when Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" and Peter replies, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," he's saying, "You're the one who have I observed, among other things, is intimately connected to God, the one who is able to help us discover who God is and live in a safe, trusting, loving relationship with the divine." That's part of the invitation of that passage there. Jesus comes to help the disciples deconstruct the images and beliefs that they have about God and the associated practices and behaviors that have been harmful and destructive in their life. And he replaces them with images and practices that help them to become whole. And that brings me back to this idea of perfection, because it's a scary word for a perfectionist. I often say to people, my motto as a recovering perfectionist is, my dad used to say to us that, I've just had that brain fart. I'll come back to that because the thought will come back to me. But there's this sense that Jesus comes to help us to I know what it was. If a job's worth doing, it's worth doing well. How many of you had your dad made me say that to you, right? So what I say, if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. It's counterintuitive. It's me challenging that perfectionist within me. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing no matter what the outcome, isn't it? So whatever it is that we do, whether we do it poorly or we perceive ourselves to do it well, it's worth doing because it's worth doing. And this is the God, and God is the God who embraces all of who we are and all of what we attempt to produce with love and tenderness and grace and pleasure, even when it is marked by the perceived imperfections that we carry with it. This is the wholeness. So when Jesus says, "Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect," he says, "Be whole, be complete," which means all those parts of yourself that you feel ashamed of, all of those parts that you want to hide, even from yourself, all of those things that are difficult, bring them all. Be complete, be whole, because here is a place where you can truly be all of yourself and find safety. And this is what he brings to the disciples. Here is a God presented in Christ whom we can be safe with. So what's clear and summing this up from these passages is that both the scriptures and our own experience teach us that our image of God, whether we view him as a loving father, as a nurturing mother, as a powerful king, as an unbending judge, as a caring shepherd, as a vengeful warrior, whatever it is that the images that you may carry, it will directly impact your way of being in the world and particularly affect the level of trust and intimacy and connectedness that you're able to have with God. In the BFG, Sophie discovered that the giant was big and friendly. She had to deconstruct and reconstruct. Or can I just put in a plug here for Grey Faith too? For those of you on this deconstruction and reconstruction journey of images and so on. Chat with Andrew or Sarah or others who are involved or have been involved in the group, and they can tell you more about a company of people who are often working through seeking to rework their imagining of God and their way of being in the world in a way that feels like trust can still be held and they can be held in trust too. But have a chat with them. And Peter and the disciples found that that Jesus was there to help them deconstruct and reconstruct their images, their beliefs, their practices, their way of being in the world, where they could be freed to love as they had been created to love. And William Young learned that he needed to reimagine God also in order to be able to continue this journey of faith. As we launch into this series over these coming weeks, A More Beautiful God and A More Beautiful Gospel, I'm trusting that we'll be able to help each other on this journey. Maybe we can talk about the images that we have. Maybe we can talk about the shadows that live within us with a trusted friend, an Anam Karam perhaps, someone who we can perhaps share what some of the shadows are that lie within us as well, finding a safe person and a safe place to be able to do some of that as well. But also to celebrate the images that bring vigor and life and quicken faith within us. Can we just pray a moment? Loving God, thank you for just that book that we were able to hear read this morning and some of those beautiful images that Rachel offers us of your being and your presence in our world. Thank you for the safety and the love and the life that we find in you. And for those, Lord, who feel like that has been broken or shredded or stretched to the point of breaking, Lord, may they too experience something of your gracious Spirit's presence, tenderly holding them in their uncertainty, holding them, Lord, in their doubting, holding them in their fragility. Hold us all, Lord, and draw us close to your heart. In Jesus' name. Amen. Now.